make people more optimistic and hopeful about the future, but to do it in a way that would, you know, give them kind of the tools they needed to also then, you know, do something if they wanted to. And so, you know, what we can do, I think, and this is what I, with my students especially, I think this is true just to the general public as well, is to become more politically informed and politically involved. And I think that was the reaction of a lot of people. I mean, the Women's March, like right after the election, to have, you know, millions of people around the world turn out like that is a show of just, you know, we want to do something. We want to have our voices heard that this is, you know, that something we need to change. And that's carried over now to the midterm elections, where we've seen a record number of women running for office in this election. And so that, I think that is just one example of this kind of involvement. Our church, Advent Lutheran in Madison, one, you know, small thing we did was to become a sanctuary. And so we actually have our first people who will be staying at the church for an indefinite period of time that, you know, needed a place to be safe. And so that's something a lot of churches are doing. And just on campus at UW, the students are more politically involved and more, I think, just interested in politics now because of this. That's the kind of more positive side of what's happened in the last year and a half. And overall, this is something that, you know, again, I told my students right after the election, is that our country has been through a lot worse. I mean, we've survived, you know, a civil war, two world wars, a Great Depression. Yeah, so this really is, in that grand scheme of things, is not that catastrophic a set of events. It's just a challenge to our institutions in a way that I think it is, in some ways, a pretty serious challenge. I'll talk about some of those today. But we have been through worse. And I am, by nature, an optimist, and I also do believe in the resilience of our American institutions. So I do think that this is just going to be another one of these, you know, parts of a long cycle of American politics. But in the talks today, one of the goals I have then for these three talks is to, you know, give you a little bit more of a sort of background on some of these issues that I think are some of the key issues facing our country today in terms of polarization and the related issues. So coming from Wisconsin, I have a little bit more personal experience with the roots of polarization, because we were kind of ground zero for polarization back in 2011 and 12. But this is the scenes from, you might remember reading about this in the news several years ago, when Scott Walker, our governor, changed the state laws to basically outlaw public employee unions. And so the teachers' unions, firefighters, the public unions were put in a position where they basically couldn't collectively bargain anymore. And this was a huge issue where we had 100,000 people turn out to one of the state capitol. Those are people occupying the state capitol inside, and the protest went on for about 6 weeks. The Democratic state senators left the state and went to Illinois, and like hid out in Illinois for about a month to be able to change the law. But finally, I guess, you know, they ran out of clean underwear, and so they had to come home. And so eventually, they did pass the law. But this really polarized our state in a way that had never been polarized before. And we'd been kind of a, you know, what they call a battleground state, fairly evenly divided between Democrats and Republicans. We'd had Republican governors, Democratic and Republican control of the state legislature. And so we were a state where, you know, both parties had been in charge at different times, but they knew how to work with the other party. And so we, you know, Tommy Thompson had been our previous governor, who worked, you know, well with Democrats on a variety of issues. Well, Scott Walker came in and basically governed like he had a 95% majority when he had a 52% majority. And he just, you know, imposed all of these very unpopular laws that divided our state in a way that made it really hard for voters to talk to each other about politics. And Tim Cullen, one of our state senators, who was kind of a moderate Democrat and worked with Republicans a lot, told stories about he would go home from Memorial Day, you know, picnics with his family, and he'd have family members who couldn't talk to each other, and his constituents who then just said that they, you know, were completely turned off from politics because of this polarization. They just felt like they couldn't talk about politics anymore. And so this was, you know, a real problem, I think, for our state. My barber for many years cut my hair for about 25 years till he retired. He cut hair till he was like 85, I think. This guy cut hair for 60 years just to, and loved to talk about politics. Well, Jack, he always was pretty careful about how he talked about his own political views. He wanted to know more what I thought about things and would offer opinions every now and then. And he once told me, he said, you know, if you put a gun to my head and made me choose, I'd probably say as a Democrat, but I don't really care for either of the parties. So he's kind of apolitical himself, but he went down to one of these protests one day, you know, just to see what it was all about, because he was seeing stuff on Fox News and other, you know, talking about how terrible the protests were. So he went down there, and the next time I saw him, he told me that he'd never been more impressed by sort of American democracy, the fact that you could have 100,000 people out there protesting, you know, completely peaceful, you know, moms with their strollers and their babies, and, you know, people giving hugs to police officers. And so it was, yeah, really a very, you know, good show of what democratic protest can be about. But it did polarize our state in a way that we still haven't really recovered from. And so, as they say, analyzing any kind of analysis, the plural of anecdote is data. So if you take some of those different kind of anecdotes, put them together, try to make sense of this. What I do as a political scientist is try to describe things, explain it, and then show why it matters. So I'll do some of that today with the topic of polarization. So first of all, just describing it, it turns out, I mean, we all know that politics is polarized today. I don't need me to tell you that. But it is a little trickier than it appears just on the surface. That, for one thing, you have to make a distinction between mass level, so the general public, and elite polarization. And with the elites are clearly polarized. I'll show you some data in a minute that demonstrate that at historic levels right now, we've never had politics as polarized as it is now for our political leaders. But the mass public is a little more complicated, that you could have two kinds of polarization. One would be sort of popular polarization that would be both partisan and ideological sorted. So the Democrats all are liberals, and the Republicans are all conservatives, and the twain shall never meet, which is what we have with our elected leaders. Or you could have just straight partisan polarization, where the parties sort without ideological polarization. And we've had, you know, some of that goes on as well. So there still are, you know, people who consider themselves to be, you know, fairly moderate but vote like Republicans, or, you know, pretty conservative but vote like Democrats. So we still do have people in the mass public who are like that. We don't have our political leaders who are like that now. We've had the complete sorting going on with them. So just looking at some of this data, the historical data, this is the snapshot of the recent Congress, where this is on a -1 to +1 scale, and the scale is based on all of the roll call votes in the House and Senate that our political leaders have had. And so -1 is the most liberal you can be, +1 is the most conservative you can be. So you see Rand Paul and Ted Cruz are out there on that end, Elizabeth Warren, Nancy Pelosi, Bernie Sanders are out here on this end for the Democrats. And the taller of the two lines on each is the House, and then the shorter, the smaller curve is the Senate. And you can see that both parties are almost non-overlapping. You have just a couple people in the middle where there's a little bit of overlap, but you're talking about, you know, one or two people out of 435 in the House and one or two senators who maybe overlap, you know, a little bit in the middle. So the two parties are almost completely separated in a way that was not true a generation ago. And this then shows it historically, going back all the way to the late 1800s. And what this shows is the distance between the two parties. So on those two curves I had, if you take the distance between those two, it, you know, has ranged from, you know, now about up to, you know, almost a full point scale in the House. And you can see we did have one other previous period of polarization almost that high, back around the turn of the 20th century. But then through, you know, most of the 20th century, the parties were not polarized. We had a lot of liberal Republicans from New England, upper Midwest. You know, there were, you know, the progressive Republicans, and, you know, people like Bob La Follette in Wisconsin was, you know, a Republican, but he was a very progressive Republican. And in New England, you have people like Nelson Rockefeller and, you know, Mitt Romney's dad in Michigan. A lot of Republicans were quite liberal. And then in the South, you had the Southern Democratic Party that was Democrats in name, but they were very conservative. And so you had the two parties really overlapped a lot. And so when you made coalitions to pass laws back in the mid part of the 20th century, the two parties were not ideologically polarized at all. And so you get these coalitions of more moderate Republicans and liberal Democrats who would pass laws, and then conservatives as well, who would, you know, lean on the conservative Democrats to pass some legislation. So what we've seen recently then is really unusual, and it's at record levels now compared to what it's been in the past. But then the public, on the other hand, is quite moderate. And so this is just a compilation of responses to like 20 different survey questions on a range of issues. And if you just lump everyone together, you can see that the public has a pretty normal distribution, around a middle point of zero, which is a moderate. Again, conservatives would be out to the right, liberals more to the left. So the public overall has a more sort of centrist distribution. But now this is a little deceptive because it does lump everyone together. And it's, if you're looking closely, it's on a different scale than that -1 to 1 scale. So another analysis sort of put the mass public on this same scale as the elites of the -1 to 1 scale, broke them down by Democrats, Republicans, and Independents. And so what you can see here is that you do get some separation. So this graph does look different than that one that's just the standard normal curve, but you still see a tremendous amount of overlap in the mass public. So compared to the one of the House and Senate, where the two parties were completely separate, here you can see, the Democrats are definitely left of center, but then you've got this whole tail over here of Democrats that are to the right of center. And the Republicans, they're definitely more to the right of center, but then you've got all of these that actually identify as liberals. Whereas independents are then the purple line, they are more, sort of normal distribution around the middle. And so this does give me more hope for sort of a polarized country when you realize that the public is not nearly as polarized as our leaders. And so, and you hear that from a lot of voters, that they just would like the parties to be able to talk to each other. They don't want our parties to be as polarized. They would like them to be able to solve problems and talk across the party aisle. So again, in comparing to the elites, you can see that's what the House and Senate look like. And then the mass public looks quite much more sort of mixed than that separation. Okay, so that kind of describes it then in general terms. So what explains this? Why do we have so much polarization today? And even in the mass public, you can see that kind of separation. So there are four main reasons that people have pointed to, and then a couple a little more speculative. But the one that I think does get a lot of attention today, and for a good reason, is the role of the media. That if you think about how the media has changed, just in one generation, and going back to when I was growing up, and it looks like there are at least a few other people in the room that remember this, we had three networks: ABC, CBS, NBC. That was it, and there was no other choice of anything else. That was all that was on TV. And national news was on at the same time for the entire country. So it had this kind of homogenizing centrist effect on politics because, people like Dan Rather and Huntley and Brinkley, and these were the voices of kind of centrist moderation. And that was the only news that everyone got when they watched news. There was, no Fox you could tune into, no MSNBC or any other, shows on the left and right. And so this produced what some people have identified as accidental learning in terms of politics, where not only was that it had that moderating effect, but it also exposed people to politics who normally didn't pay much attention to politics. And now, if people don't care about politics, they'll tune into ESPN or they'll tune into the shopping network or whatever they want to look at, and they won't even watch the news anymore. But most American households have the TV on, basically from late afternoon until early evening. And so the TV would be on, and people would listen to the news, at least in the background when they're getting dinner ready or whatever. And so they would learn about politics, even if they weren't trying. That's the idea of accidental learning then. And they were learning about it then in a more moderate centrist way. So think about how that contrasts with today, with the segmented media, where people choose to watch the type of media they agree with. And then you get this second effect of the non-politically interested, people who don't care about politics, not turning on the news at all. So they're just watching something else, or on the internet, not even paying attention to politics. And so you get this more intense views then that happen to the people who care about politics, And they're hearing about it from a more one-sided perspective. They're not getting that kind of centrist orientation anymore. And so that has had a big effect on how the consumption of news has affected people's political views and polarized those views. Then you combine that with the internet then. And here there are two kind of components to this that both feed into the polarization. And one is this idea of ideological silos. So again, the self-selection to areas of the internet where you're only going to hear views that you agree with, and you're not going to websites that challenge your preconceived views. And that's something that most people do. But then Google and other search engines reinforce that by the way the algorithms work for when you search for something. They base it on your search histories. And so if you type in climate change and you're a liberal, you'll be sent to one set of websites. And if you type in climate change and you're conservative, you'll be sent to a different set of websites based on your searching history. Now, that's a really useful thing when you're shopping for a pair of shoes or whatever. It's nice that Google knows like where you like to go, and it can be very helpful to save you time in terms of the efficiency of your searching. But when it's about politics, I think that has a really corrosive effect on the political system, because again, it's not letting people, it's hard to find out information then when you're searching, because it's sending you to places where you already agree with those views. And so that just contributes to that polarization. So I think those are probably the two biggest things that have affected polarization at the mass level. Then the third thing is responding to our polarized elites. That because our elites are so polarized, the views they're expressing when they're either on the campaign trail or just in Washington or in our state capitals, they're putting out positions and policies that are more polarizing. So we tend to respond to that in a more polarized way as well. And then finally, there have been some social demographers who have looked at what they call geographical sorting, that we have seen some evidence of this now in the last decade or so, of people actually moving to neighborhoods where they can be with people who are more like themselves politically. And so that's why you see such a difference right now between urban areas and suburban areas in terms of the partisan profile of those different places to live. And that gap has grown in the last decade as well. So there's definitely some of that kind of geographical sorting going on as well. Now, some more speculative reasons that there's not as much evidence for this, but just kind of some correlations that are interesting. Though, is income inequality and percent foreign-born correlate very highly with polarization. So Gini index is an index that economists use to measure economic inequality. It's a very sort of standard measure they use. And that's on the right-hand axis. And then the polarization measure is on the left-hand axis. And you can see those two things are really strongly related. That if you see any correlation over 0.7, that's considered to be a pretty strong relationship. 0.93, that's like a perfect correlation is 1.0. That's if you're two variables that are on the same dotted line, basically. And so it's hard to unpack exactly why that's going on, but you can see that the two definitely move together, that as our countries become more unequal in terms of wealth and income, it also has become more polarized in terms of partisan positions. And so there's at least some evidence that's happened. But then the other one, oops, here. The other percent foreign-born, and this too, going back all the way to the data from the late 1800s, you can see those two also are correlated, not quite as strongly, 0.77. But in periods of high levels of immigration, you have high polarization. So we had a big wave of immigration, late 1800s, early 1900s, tails off, mid part of the 20th century, polarization goes down. Immigration takes off again as the percent foreign-born increases through the 70s and 80s and 90s, and polarization goes up in that period. So again, there it's a little easier to tell a story. I mean, it's Donald Trump and the election of 2016 that he made immigration kind of front and center of his campaign, and that clearly is a very polarizing issue. And so I think it's a little easier to come up with some sort of story of how those two could be related, but definitely the correlation is there. Okay, so to talk a little more now about the most recent experience of polarization and the election of Donald Trump, There is some interesting evidence that has come out of the MIT Media Lab, where they looked at a billion tweets about the election from the year before, in August 2015, up until Election Day. There were 67 million users that they analyzed. And they looked at how people sorted through this, what they called network analysis, to see, you know, where the people who were tweeting, where they would clump on different issues. And there's some fascinating things that they found. And so here is the, just as you would expect, you see kind of a separation of Trump supporters and Clinton supporters. And this cloud, you know, shows the concentration of communications between different people. Of the 67 million people, they're depicted in this cloud. The Trump supporters tend to pump more together. They're the red are the follow only Trump, and you see them down in the right hand side. And then the blue ones follow only Clinton, and the purple ones follow both. And so you can see that there really is a very strong separation for the Trump supporters. And then the Clinton supporters are a little less cohesive. They're kind of a little, you know, spread out a little bit more than the Trump supporters. And they do have some interactions then with people that do follow Trump or follow both. And so the polarization appeared to be more, you know, with the Trump supporters than with the Clinton supporters, at least if you're using Twitter as a basis. And then this is breaking down by issues, which is really interesting, where you see the, you know, how, again, based on the type of issue, you can see the color, and then the percentage shows the number of people who were tweeting, you know, on those issues. So guns and racial issues and immigration were the top three. 10% of all tweets about guns, about 8.5% on racial issues and immigration. Interestingly, guns is, you know, more, you give more of it a focus up on with the Clinton supporters. I'm sorry, the racial issues, you see more of a focus among the Clinton supporters, the green area, and with the guns you see more of the Trump supporters with the purple. But you see some mix though. So like with the guns, you do see a big cluster up there with the Clinton supporters as well, who are worried about gun control. And then here with Trump supporters, obviously worried more about, you know, Second Amendment right to own guns. And so that you do see some on both sides. Whereas racial issues do appear more on the Clinton side. So they were, you know, worried about what's happening with the Trump supporters and race. And so you see quite a bit you know, of a cluster there with the Clinton supporters. And this is one that kind of fascinated me too as an educator. The little green dots over here are education, the folks on education, and they are in a little world of their own, like completely over here, like separate from everyone else. It's only 4% of the, you know, the tweets, but still, like completely separate, like almost no interaction. That whole discussion is happening in this own little space by itself, with very little interaction to the rest of the Twitter space, which to me, you know, says a lot about some of the problems that education is having right now. That I think that it's not, you know, being talked enough with, you know, sort of all of the other issues that are going on. And so a lot of interesting things you can unpack with that analysis of the Twitter and the tweets from all the 67 million people. And then finally, this is another thing they did, which I think is just fascinating too. And this is, we're talking about the media bubble. Like, why didn't anyone see the election of Trump coming? And some people, like, blame it on the media, that they just, you know, weren't focusing on the right issues, they weren't aware of what was going on in Trump's world. And this seems to verify that. So the orange dots are verified journalists. So these are journalists who have a Twitter feed. So these are, you know, the actual professional journalists who are out there tweeting. And you can see that almost non-existent in the Trump world. Like, there's almost no orange dots over there on the Trump side. They're all over here on the Clinton side and more in the middle. And so the journalists just were not tuned in to at all what was happening in among Trump supporters. And so they did miss, I think, a lot of what was happening, what was going on. So that is a little disconcerting in terms of the role of the media. Which brings up another point then that got a lot of attention after the election and certainly contributed to polarization as well, and that's the whole idea of fake news. And this is the analysis done, it was reported on BuzzFeed, showing that fake news in terms of engagement on Facebook, so the liking something or reposting it on Facebook, you know, how many times it happened in this analysis they did, that fake news actually surpassed mainstream news in terms of the amount that was being shared on Facebook in the run-up to the election. And so these were stories that were just on their face ridiculous. So these are some of the top shared stories. You know, Pope Francis shocks world, endorses Donald Trump for president. A million shares there 3 months before the election. WikiLeaks confirms Hillary sold weapons to ISIS, then drops another bombshell. Breaking news, and that gets reposted 789,000 times. It's over. Hillary's ISIS email just leaked. It's worse than anyone could have imagined. Just read the law. Hillary is disqualified from holding any federal office. And so all of this stuff gets retweeted, and now we're finding out actually that some of this was done by Russian bots and other Russian infiltrators who were posting on internet sites and getting people to repost. And so pretty clearly this kind of information has had a bigger impact than we can possibly know with any certainty, but it has had. It did have an impact on the election to some extent when you have that many kind of posts of this completely made-up news. Okay, so what's next? The media, I think, has understood part of what happened in 2016 as being their responsibility, and I think they are doing a much better job now of playing their traditional watchdog role. That's one thing that we need for a working democracy is to have a strong media that does hold our political leaders accountable. And so this is something I think that the media is doing a much better job of doing now, and making sure that the information that they're finding out is getting read by the American public. Now, we still have the silo problem that there are still people who aren't reading some of the more critical analytical stuff that's coming out, and so that there's... It's hard to reach people who don't want to be reached, and there's no good answer for that. But at least the media, I think, is now seeing the problem and started to address that. Congress is definitely still not figured out how to govern, and is very gridlocked. That Paul Ryan's resignation, I think, was in part just frustration with not being able to run the House anymore. The Freedom Caucus has stood in his way since he's been Speaker. And there, even in the last month or two, there's been a complete breakdown of the budget process where the budget committees now have decided they're not even going to do a budget resolution this year, which has never happened since the law was passed back in the 1970s. And so Congress, I think, clearly is having a hard time governing. The Republican Party wasn't expecting to have Trump win either, I don't think. And so when they had unified control of government, they really didn't know quite what they were supposed to do in terms of governing, so they've been divided amongst themselves and not able to pass legislation the way that they typically would be doing at this point. But the midterm elections, I think, will be a key test for my thesis that the American institutions are resilient and that the kind of the self-corrective element of American politics that we've seen historically will get a real test this fall. And I'll talk on Tuesday about the the different forecasts and historically what we've seen in midterm elections. And right now, just as a little teaser, most forecasts are saying that it's about a 50-50 chance Democrats will retake the House, less of a chance of that in the Senate, but this is going to be a very competitive set of elections this fall. So I wanted to make sure to leave plenty of time for discussion and questions. So that's all I wanted to say today. And we'll just open it up and see what questions you have or other things you want to ask about this.
Well, something that came to mind about your graph about the different times in history that that look worse than today. You didn't mention the Vietnam War, and I thought, well, that has to be one of them. And then I saw that the Democrats and Republicans were pretty much aligned.
Right.
So could you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, no, that's a good, very good question. So the Vietnam War, I think, is an example of kind of the opposite of what we have today, where the elites were pretty unified, that they were very much, sort of Cold War, anti-Russia, we've got to, stop the Soviet Union, the saying at the time was, you know, politics stops at the water's edge. That as soon as it becomes a foreign issue, like, we're all Americans and, you know, we're not Democrats or Republicans anymore. And so, you know, you had, you know, Lyndon Johnson, a Democratic president, you know, leading the war effort. And Hubert Humphrey, who was, you know, running for president in 68, not breaking with that position until very, you know, late in the campaign. And so Democrats and Republicans, the leaders, were, you know, pretty much in agreement about the Vietnam War. And so they weren't polarized on that issue. But the American public was very polarized and deeply polarized. And so in a way, it's exactly the opposite of what we have today, which is very polarized elite, and the mass public not as polarized as our leaders. So it is a interesting historical parallel, but yeah, in a way that's kind of reversed.
I was wondering also about the use of the 1880s, and you didn't go before that on the graph of political polarization. So you did go back to the immigration before, but I was wondering, is that would kind of be left over from how heated things were after the Civil War, or
right.
Or do you mostly attribute that to percentage of people that were immigrants?
Yeah, no, right. So, yes, yeah, so the other period of polarization, biggest period of polarization we had was in that period of Reconstruction after the Civil War, and it was not until really World War I that it starts to become, you know, less polarized at that point. So I think you're exactly right. I think it is very much the remnants of that partisan division that happened because of the Civil War, where you have the, you know, the Republicans in the North, Democrats in the South. The Republican Party was the party of Lincoln for, you know, two generations. That was, they called it waving the bloody shirt, that any time, you know, that a Republican would try to run the South, they just, you know, they didn't exist for like two generations after the Civil War. And so the parties were very deeply divided over a whole range of issues that were kind of spillover from that. And it takes about two generations before that starts to diminish. And then you have, and I think it is probably World War I, and then the Great Depression, you can see, is the other time when it really starts to become more unified. The distance is smaller between the two parties, because I think that at that point the Republican Party was pretty much wiped out with, you know, FDR in the 30s, with the first election in 32, then in 36. Democrats just had huge majorities, and so the Republicans kind of went along with all of the New Deal policies, and so you didn't see that deep polarization in national politics, you know, for much of that time. You had the kind of New Deal consensus that went through much of the 30s and 40s, and then the with World War II, again, you get the foreign policy consensus behind, you know, fighting Germany and the war effort, and then you have the other thing that I talked about of the geographic divisions being less distinct than they are now. You had the New England Republicans and the Midwest, Upper Midwest Republicans, and you had the Southern Democrats. So the parties themselves weren't as unified. So that made these polarization levels, you know, smaller in that mid part of the 20th century as well, in addition to some of these other issue-based, you know, kinds of explanations. But yeah, absolutely, the earlier period would have been, you know, more of a consequence of the carryover from the Civil War.
Would there be a route to, so our current political polarization, just from that graph, it looks like you put it about the beginning of Clinton's term, but he's actually known for compromising a lot with the other side.
Yep.
Would there be, I mean, you maybe don't want to say cause, but
yeah.
Would there be things you would point to in there that would,
yep,
that would got to us toward position?
Yes, the biggest jump, so right in here, you know, comes with the Republican takeover of the House in 94. So that's Clinton's in office for 2 years. The Republicans take over the House for the first time in 50 years. Like, they hadn't held, maybe 40 years. I guess the first time in 40 years Republicans had majority control of the House. And that's when you get that big jump. Newt Gingrich and the, you know, the Contract of America. And so that, the sort of House politics had been much less polarized under the previous leadership of Bob Michael and the other Republicans who worked more with, like, you know, Tip O'Neill had been the Speaker, and he worked well with the Republican leaders. And then when Newt Gingrich comes in, he basically defeated that wing of the Republican Party. And Gingrich had a much more aggressive approach, where it was kind of a take no prisoners, kind of like Scott Walker I talked about in Wisconsin. you know, that we're just, we have our way of doing things and we're going to oppose Bill Clinton. And Clinton, you know, did try to compromise, and they did get a few things that were bipartisan, like NAFTA and, you know, crime bill and, you know, some other things that they were in welfare reform, you know, they got through with bipartisan compromise. But overall, that's when you see that big jump in partisan politics, was that era of Newt Gingrich and the Republican takeover of the House in 1994. And I have some other graphs I could have shown too, but the other thing that's interesting to see, you know, when this opens up in the 90s, it's the Republicans becoming more conservative, not the Democrats becoming more liberal in general. Now, Southern Democrats become somewhat more liberal, in part because you have African Americans being elected to the South for the first time. It used to be all these conservative white Southern Democrats, but then starting in 92, you get some African Americans being elected to the House, and so you do see Southern Democrats becoming more liberal. But it's mostly Republicans becoming more conservative that leads to the divide, in the House especially.
My question is, how do you know, because of the Russian cyber warfare that's been going on, how do you know that your data is actually accurate with the Twitter and leading up to the, now that we know that Russia has actually did a lot to create the chaos and division, deliberately divided people, especially on Twitter.
Right.
How do you know that this data is actually true?
Well, so we know that the data are accurate in terms of, you know, where the different issue positions are and where the networks are and so on. What we don't know, And one of my colleagues in Wisconsin, Youngmi Kim, has probably some of the best data on this, where it was just one of the most fortuitous things in terms of a research project I've ever heard of. She obviously didn't anticipate this happening, but she knew that, you know, Facebook and Twitter, she focused just on Facebook, but she knew that the social media were becoming much more important in politics. And we hadn't had any really good analyses of what people actually saw on their Facebook pages. We knew what was posted, but we didn't know what people were consuming. And so, like, a year before the election, she got this big grant to do a study where she actually got people to record for her, to take screenshots of whatever it was that was political, and save it for her. So she had, like, I don't know, 5,000, 10,000 people or something that did this, where they, every time they clicked on something or liked something or, you know, forwarded something to a friend, whatever, on Facebook, they made a record of it for her. And so she has, like, tens of thousands, in the hundreds of thousands, I think, the total number of different posts on Facebook. And she's been able to go back and look at the origins, then, of where these original posts came from. So she has some of the best evidence that we have today of the Russian influence. And she found it was something on the order of about 10%. Of all of the posts that she analyzed that had some political content were coming from either clearly Russian or at least suspect Russian sources. So these data for this broad sweep of the, you know, billion of tweets with 67 million users, we know those actually happened. So that part of it's real. What we don't know is, like, how many of those end up, you know, coming from Russian sources. And we'll never know that because we didn't have a research design that was set up to figure that out. But with my colleague in Wisconsin, we at least have some sense of Facebook that, you know, appears to be about 10% or so of the total posts, of the people anyway in her sample, appear to have some, you know, Russian source.
Because I was just listening to New York Times reporter on this NPR program that I was listening to, Fresh Air, and he was saying that actually, the biggest Russian weapon isn't a bomb.
Right.
It's cyber warfare.
Absolutely.
And that they know that the Russians opened all these Twitter accounts.
Yep.
And so we don't really know what if
proportion.
These are American citizens or not.
Right, no, for sure. And there's no doubt that many of those tweets were coming from foreign sources and from Russian sources. And one thing that both Facebook and Twitter now have made more of an effort to try to get a handle on the fake news aspect of this, where something is so clearly outrageous as some of those that I put up there, they're actually trying to stop, you know, some of those from being able to, you know, continue to proliferate on the internet, because it is a really corrosive effect, I think, on American politics to have, you know, all of that, you know, complete, you know, fake news that is out there. But you're right, that something we'll never know is like what proportion of those 67 million users were actually American citizens or not. We'll just, you know, never have, you know, firm evidence on that.
I'm real interested in psychology, and I was just looking at the internet this afternoon. And there's a guy that just wrote a book. He's not a psychologist, but he spent 7 years intensely looking at what different opinions are by psychologists and so on about Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And what seems to be a consensus of experts, though they can't say that out loud, is that Donald Trump has an attachment disorder, because he had 2.5 his mother in giving birth to her youngest child, was really compromised physically, and had 4 surgeries in 2 years, and major surgeries, and basically he was abandoned from his primary caregiver. And so the contrast was made with FDR and how their personalities differ so much, and the correlation of what their childhood was and the impact that has on the president's ability to empathize authentically with the people.
Right.
And according to your graph there, when FDR was in office, that was a time at which the country came together. And of course, it was during the Second World War, and I mean, he was able to rally everybody in such an incredible way to win that war.
Yeah, so there's been a lot of work on psychology and presidency that dates back even to the late 70s, early 80s. There have been quite a few studies done of especially presidents like Lincoln, Wilson, Nixon, are the other ones that people have pointed to having, you know, pretty serious, you know, mental issues that, you know, Lincoln almost certainly was like clinically depressed. There's no doubt that, but yet he managed to be a great, probably most historians say our greatest president. And so, having a serious, you know, mental sort of challenge isn't necessarily something that, you know, is debilitating for a president. But on the other hand, Richard Nixon is another one where I think his, you know, mental issues did have a serious effect on the presidency in terms of, you know, being so paranoid about people who were out to get him, and, you know, going to the White House tapes of the way that he would rail against people that he disagreed with, and so on. And so pretty clearly that had a direct effect on his, you know, actions that led to Watergate, and so we know the outcome of that. And with Trump now, we're just, you know, starting to learn more about, you know, these kinds of things. I'm sure we'll see, you know, many books written about it, you know, from the psychological perspective in the next, you know, several years. But there does, you know, I think there clearly is something to that in terms of Trump's, you know, neediness in terms of having approval from people, and, you know, how he, you know, just, you know, thrives on those, you know, the large crowds of his, you know, supporters is something that he, you know, like needs, you know, that kind of constant reaffirmation. And then the danger side of that is to be surrounded by people who are just supporting him. Like, he really doesn't want any dissent within the White House, whereas FDR was the opposite. Like, he absolutely, and successful presidents are ones who want people to challenge them and to give them different perspectives, and then to choose the best course from, you know, a set of different perspectives, not just being told always that, yes, sir, you're correct, and you're the best president ever. That's not very helpful for making tough decisions. And so I think that you're absolutely right that is something a lot of people pointed out about Trump that is, I think, a challenge, certainly.
I guess I would argue that the most dangerous time in our democracy was the Sedition Act.
Yeah.
Because, and I'm kind of struck by some of the similarities between Donald Trump and John Adams.
Yep.
I just wondered if you had a comment about that.
Yeah, so the Sedition Acts were definitely the most serious challenge ever to the freedom of the press and to the First Amendment. And they actually did throw journalists in jail under those laws that made it basically a crime to criticize the government, which, you know, is mind-boggling when you look at the language of the First Amendment, which is, you know, very much opposed to that. Now, they only were on the books for a couple of years when Jefferson was elected. They, you know, they were done away with, and so I think it was like only 2 years or something that they were actually in effect. But I agree that that was definitely a major challenge to our, especially because it was so early in our history. It was a major challenge to the survival of the American sort of democratic experiment. But I think now, while you're right, I think it's some parallels today, especially with Trump's criticism of the press all the time, and the whole fake news, like calling the New York Times, you know, fake news, and the Washington Post fake news, you know, as he does, you know, clearly is meant as a challenge to the integrity and the respect for the press. I mean, clearly he's trying to shake people's confidence in the press. And so there is that historic parallel, I think, that is exactly right. What makes me, I think, more optimistic that I don't think that will be successful is that our institutions are so much more well-established now. And we have a strong operating media that has been in place for so long that, and with such a strong history, that I don't think any one president has the ability to undermine that. That it's too strong, and people just wouldn't put up with it. So that, whereas in the early period of our nation's history with Adams, I mean, that was a serious threat. I mean, that could have, you know, led us down the path towards a more totalitarian kind of state had that been allowed to continue. But yeah, I think our institutions are strong enough now, and our media is strong enough now it's harder to imagine that happening today anyway. I'm not saying if it couldn't happen, it's harder to imagine that happening today. But again, as I said, I'm an eternal optimist, so maybe I'm not the right person to be offering those opinions. But, you know, so.
Well, I found it hard to imagine that we would have a president that lies every time he opens his mouth. That after the election, watching the press trying to grapple with the news when they're trying to report the facts, and they have a president who they know is now saying something different than he said yesterday.
Right.
And how do you report that to the public? They would not call him a liar. I mean, they were skirting, the way they skirted around it was comical. And now many of them don't have a problem calling him a liar, and others are a little more diplomatic about it.
Right. But you do see things now, though, and this is where it goes straight to the point I was talking about, the media doing a better job, I think, of reporting now than they did before the election, is that you see these compilations of the, you know, like 800 statements that Trump has made that are not factually correct, and they, you know, give them different labels of whether or not they call them lies or not, but there are these running tallies that are, you know, many, many media sources are doing this now, and so I think that you're right. They did struggle with that for the first couple of months. It was really, because this was so new, completely new territory that we had never experienced that before. So how do you deal with that? And you're right, they were kind of tripping over themselves for a while to figure out what to do.
I think they thought that once the election happened, that he would straighten out.
Right.
That, you know, he'd get rid of his campaign rhetoric and things would go smoothly.
Yeah.
But we saw, at least I saw it during the campaign, when I was looking at the debate online and watching fact-checking while he's talking.
Right.
You know, that was new to me.
He goes by a different source, correct?
Well, I mean, he often doesn't have much in the way of sources. It's just like whatever he...
I thought it was a conspiracy source or something.
Well, I mean, he watches Fox News in the morning. I mean, it's where he gets a lot of his news. He said he, often you can see something that was on Fox in the morning, and then within like 30 minutes, he'll be tweeting on that exact topic. So that, if you one single source for him, probably the biggest source is pretty clearly Fox News. But beyond that, I think he just responds to things he hears from friends and from some advisors. Clearly have his ear as well. But it does. That's been one frustration for the people who work in the White House is that it is hard to be able to move him away from positions where he's been convinced that something is true.
Do you see a major risk to our country where free public education is being compromised?
Well, there certainly are more threats to public education now than any time in recent years. But that maybe we've turned the corner in that as well with the recent strike in West Virginia and then in Oklahoma. And I think we have seen, at least in some states, that we've kind of hit rock bottom. We have to turn the corner on supporting public education. So the support for public education is at historic lows in a lot of states. But again, I think that seems to be turning a corner in the states where those cuts have been the deepest. The broader challenges come in the areas of the private vouchers for private schools, which a lot of states have gone to. And so you're just eliminating part of the revenue base for schools, and that is hurt public education quite a bit. And that will continue, I think, to be a challenge. But I think the education is still something. If you look at the data had up about public moderate, the public's moderate positions on issues, you still get large majorities of the public who want support for public education. That they want either to continue existing goals or increase funding for public education, not to cut funding. And so that is an issue where you do get fairly strong bipartisan agreement that people do want to support public education.
Well, it's really interesting to see the data.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming. And